As Kurt Gortney with KGOU reports, the tribe's acquiring a gaming company that will expand its business into two other states.
The tribe's gambling subsidiary, Global Gaming Solutions, has agreed to buy two casinos and other parts of a bankrupt Louisiana gambling company. The purchase of Legends Gaming includes casinos in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Bossier City, Louisiana. Both operate under the name of Diamond Jack Casinos. The deal won't be complete until it wins approval from the courts and regulators in both states. A statement from the Legends company says it will continue normal operations at both of its casinos. The CEO for Global Gaming told the Journal Record newspaper the acquisition is a major expansion for the company. The Chickasaw Nation's gaming company also owns Remington Park Racetrack Casino in Oklahoma City and 13 other casinos, including its largest, Windstar, in Thackerville, Oklahoma, on the Oklahoma-Texas border. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
The U.S. Justice Department is holding tribal consultations this week in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Federal officials are speaking today at the 7th Annual Tribal Consultation on Violence Against Women. On Wednesday and Thursday, sessions on tribal justice, safety, and wellness will take place. It includes a listening session on the plan to implement the Tribal Law and Order Act. There will also be training and technical assistance for attendees. A federal judge dismisses a South Dakota tribe's lawsuit against beer makers. According to the Associated Press, the suit by the Oglala Sioux Tribe was dismissed Monday against beer makers and stores in White Clay, Nebraska. It blamed them for alcoholism and associated problems on the nearby reservation. Millions of cans of beer are sold in the small town a year. The tribe could take its claims to state court. Police in Canada announced a break in cases involving missing and murdered women in British Columbia last month. There are hundreds of such cases across the country, many involving Aboriginal women. Advocacy groups work year-round to keep attention on cases and help the families of missing and murdered women. A Manitoba group holds a free concert to raise funds. The 2012 fourth annual event, No Stone Unturned, was held this summer in Winnipeg. The coalition of families of missing and murdered women and girls put on the event. Bernadette Smith is the coalition's founder.
This was a chance for families to come together to tell their stories, to talk about their loved ones, to celebrate their lives, and for them to see that, you know, there are people in the community that do care. It was all run on donations, so we had over 20 entertainers this year, and every year it's grown.
The group created a toolkit for families. Smith says families often don't know where to turn or what to do when their loved one goes missing.
We created this toolkit last year. It's now been out and circulating not only in our province but in many others. And it really focuses on helping you to deal with the media, dealing with police, how to make a poster, what counseling services are out there. We really found that families weren't taking care of themselves, so there's a self-care piece in there. You know, what can we do to honor, you know, our pain and our grief that we're going through, and to really let families know that what they're experiencing is natural, and to really honor how they're feeling and let them know that it's normal.
Smith created the group after her sister Claudette Osborne went missing in July 2008. At 21 years old, Osborne went missing. The mother of four had just given birth.
We don't give up hope that she will come home, you know, alive one day. If we don't have hope, we don't have anything. And we just continue to honor her memory.
Smith says there's a task force of police reviewing cases in the province. She knows of more than 70 cases of missing and murdered women in Manitoba. During this month in 2011, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe and Colorado State Historic Preservation Office signed a cultural resources management plan. The first of its kind agreement included helping build a website and database for records, surveying work, and other cultural resources work. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes after three. You're in tune with KTOO News, and we have guests with us in the studio right now who are with the Suicide Prevention Task Force in Juneau, and there's an upcoming Survivors of Suicide Support Group, but it's clear into November. But the reason these folks are here to talk about it is because there's a pre-registration process. So with me are Chris Cairns and Sandra Sexton-Jones. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
So tell us what folks will be doing at this suicide survivor support group.
The full name of it is Educational and Support Group, Survivors of Suicide Educational and Support Group. It's an 8-week course, and it's designed for individuals who have obviously lost someone, you know, by suicide. The registration process, even though the group is free, we only have limited space. There'll be space for 10 members, and we'll go through the 8 weeks. The 8 weeks cover, you know, from the beginning of them talking about their story, telling about their person, and then the successive weeks take them through the things that they may experience through the process. Sections talk about reviewing the purpose of the group and what it's designed to do, and then to have them talk about, as they go through this group's process, talk about their week, what was good and what was bad. Because what we find is that most survivors, at least early on, focus only on the negative in terms of their life and how their life is going. And so it's important to lead them through, you know, getting to a place where they can recognize it's okay to laugh, it's okay to have fun, it's okay to live and live well. And so it's, you know, it documents to a certain extent their progress and helps them look at, you know, what it means for them to live without the person that they've lost. In some of the language that centers around a loss of suicide, they talk about recovery. And that word has lost a little bit of its popularity. I don't know that you ever really, quote, recover from having a loss by suicide. Basically, what you do is you learn to live with the fact that this happened in your family. And so there's more like an accommodation of what the event was in your life. One of the examples that I use is a tapestry. There may be a tear in the tapestry, but the tapestry can be repaired. You're always aware of that repair, but the tapestry is still usable and still very functional and still looks pretty, even with, you know, the repair in it. And so at the end of the group, the idea is that by the time they get to the end of the group, they will have a better understanding of, you know, their feelings, their emotions, a place to express their anger, their guilt, whatever it is, and, you know, live forward from there.
Sandra, you're a clinician here in Juneau, and I'm taking it from as much as you know about how this is going to work, that you're actually going to be the leader of the
I will be the facilitator. And I'm also a survivor.
Ah, so yeah. This is the voice of experience.
Yes.
Yeah. Chris, the agent or the organization that's actually sponsoring this is, you're involved with them, that's the Suicide Prevention Task Force. Who's the umbrella over that?
Well, it's itself sort of an umbrella. Ah. It's a community-based organization that's very broad-based. It comprises a majority of the mental health agencies in town, as well as a lot of private citizens, survivors of suicide loss. The police department is an active member of the coalition. It's really pretty broad-based. They'd almost be quicker to tell you which agencies aren't partaking.
Now, I know two things recently in the news. One is that we just had an in-service in the Juneau schools, and the first 2 hours of that in-service last week on Thursday, I think, was a suicide prevention course. Did you have anything to do with that?
I'm not familiar with last 2 weeks, but I do know that at the end of this month of October, we're doing a thing that we do every year for all ninth graders. They receive some education. I think it's a two-hour curriculum on
ninth graders, your first
what they call science
and
suicide. Yeah, it's trying to promote help-seeking behavior in children for themselves and for their friends, so they can recognize signs, symptoms of depression and self-refer. But there's also a screening component to it. So after the curriculum is presented, the children, all the ninth graders, will take basically what amounts to a depression screen. And then those kids, that day, the people who throw this event will go through all the responses and triage if there's any kids that need immediate services and facilitate the meeting of those services.
The other thing, I know it's beyond the scope of what you're talking about, but I was very impressed with the fact that the United States military took a stand-down day about a week ago, in which all of the people in the military went through a suicide prevention sequence of training. That was quite. I hadn't realized the military would do that kind of thing, but they certainly are becoming very concerned about it.
It's become very serious. The combat casualties or suicides outnumbered combat casualties in July of this year, so it's becoming a big issue.
Correct.
Sandra, I wanted to ask you, you said family member at one point. I'm wondering how many degrees of separation a person should consider before thinking they should take your or be in your group.
I'm glad you asked that. Anyone that has experienced a suicide, of whether it's a friend, a coworker, you know, anyone that has experienced a suicide, it does not necessarily have to only be a family member, because there's not that much of a degree of separation when you look at the person that's in the center that, you know, has killed themselves. And because as it ripples out, you know, there are family members, there are friends, there are coworkers, you know, it ripples out into a fairly wide circle. And the length of time doesn't matter either. I wanted to put that in there. I was asked not too long ago about attending the group when the event had occurred in this person's life 20-some-odd years ago. But the very fact that she came up to me and mentioned it, it's still something that resonates in her life. And so I said, absolutely, you know, come in to the group if that's what you'd like to do. We also used, we'll be using two books. There's one that's pretty much of a standard practice that's used in these groups. It's called After Suicide by John Hewitt. And then they'll also be using my little book that I wrote a number of years ago.
Which is entitled?
The first go-round, when we printed it, it was called This is Survivable. And then the second time, the second printing, or actually the third printing, I guess, was When Someone You Love Completes Suicide.
Huh.
And so those two will be our curriculum for the duration of the group.
Go ahead.
Can I say that in addition to, you know, the process of working through the curriculum of this group, I think that one of the major benefits is just building a community of survivors. I think that enduring a loss by suicide can be profoundly alienating, and, you know, there's a lot of complex emotion that goes into that, like guilt and shame, feeling responsibility for, you know, your loved one's actions, or even anger at, you know, their actions. And it can feel like you're the only person in the world that understands, you know, how that is. And this group is really about building a community and opening up that dialogue between people, so that they can really feel like there is a way through, a way towards a new normal, I guess you could say.
Living forward.
Yeah, living forward.
Living forward.
So if someone has been touched by this and is thinking that they should be in this group, how do they go about that process?
They can contact me. Do you want a phone number?
Yes.
It's my cell phone is 209-2263. They can also contact Chris.
At NAMI Juno, which is 463-4251.
Okay. And is there a website people could go to get information?
Yeah, you could go to junosuicideprevention.org. That is actually not – the information on this group is not live yet, but it will be very soon, and you can register through that webpage as well.
Okay. And the date by which people must be registered for the pre-screening is?
I don't have a calendar in front of me.
Okay.
Preferably by November 1st.
Okay.
With the group starting on the Tuesday the 6th, I believe it is.
Okay. So probably the date that you'd want to have yourself in and could start the screening process would
Correct.
Be November 1st. Okay, fine. And so this is a Survivors of Suicide Support Group. You gave us a full name for it, though, at the start.
Survivors of Suicide Educational and Support Group.
Okay.
It is not a therapy group. I don't want anyone to think that it is. It's not.
Okay, so it's mostly to educate, to help you work through the process.
Yes.
The entire course lasts 8 weeks and begins on the 6th of November?
The 6th of November.
Okay, good. So 6th of November,
yes.
And then nights following that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much for coming in and alerting our listeners to the possibility of attending this.
Thank you very
thank
much
you.
For having us.
Yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. Just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Seen sunny days that I thought would never end. Times when I could not find a friend, but I always thought that I'd see you again. Been walking my mind to an easy time, my back turned towards the sun. Lord knows when the cold wind blows, it'll turn your head around. Well, as I was time on the telephone line to talk about things to come, sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you, baby, one more time again now. Thought I'd see you one more time again. There's just a few things coming my way this time around now. Thought I'd
Twenty minutes after 3 o'clock.
This is Bird Note. A bald eagle soars above the Elwha River on the northern edge of Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. A century ago, two dams were built on the Elwha. Prior to those dams, salmon battled their way up the steeply cascading river to spawn. And every fall, hundreds of eagles feasted on the spent fish. The dams reduced the river's salmon population by more than 90%. But now, after nearly 40 years of negotiation, meetings, and planning, the largest dam removal project in United States history is underway. Citizens, politicians, electric utilities, biologists, lawyers, and Native Americans all had a part. By the fall of 2011, water had begun flowing freely past the former Lower Elwha Dam. By 2013, the upper dam will also have come down. The river's salmon runs may grow from 3,000 to 400,000 fish. The bald eagle soaring past the former dam site today may not live to enjoy that bonanza, but his progeny will flock to the headwaters each fall when the dinner bell of spent Elwha salmon resounds across the countryside. There's more information at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Tune in Wednesday night to K2 News from 5 to 7 to hear the first presidential debate of election season. Guy Raz will host NPR's coverage, which will feature moderator Jim Lehrer and questions on domestic policy. Again, that's the first presidential debate, broadcast live on K2 News from 5 to 7 this Wednesday night.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 2nd of October, 2012. It's the birthday of King Richard III of England, born at Fotheringay Castle in Northamptonshire, 1452. He was the 11th child of the Duke of York. He was the last of the Plantagenet dynasty, which had held the throne since 1154. He fought at Bosworth Field in the final battle of the Wars of the Roses, and there Richard III became the last English king to die on the battlefield. He was 32. He had reigned for only 2 years, and his opponent, Henry Tudor, then became King Henry VII. He has a bad reputation, Richard III. Shakespeare was not kind to him in his play. Richard did imprison his young nephews, one of whom was about to be crowned king, imprisoned them in the Tower of London, spread gossip about them, said they were illegitimate, took the throne for himself, was crowned that July, and the little princes disappeared in August, their fate still a mystery. It's the birthday of Wallace Stevens, the poet, born in Reading, Pennsylvania, 1879, worked as an executive for the Hartford Accident and Indemnity Company, walked 2 miles to and from work every day, and that's when he wrote his poems, writing down lines on slips of paper, gave them to his secretary to type up when he got to the office. It's the birthday of Graham Greene, the novelist, Hertfordshire, England, 1904, author of The Power and the Glory, The End of the Affair, Our Man in Havana. During the Battle of Britain, his home in London was bombed by the Germans one night, and Greene would have been killed, except that he was spending the night with his mistress. His wife later said his life was saved because of his infidelity. It was on this day, 1950, the comic strip Peanuts made its debut, drawn by Charles M. Schulz. He was 28 years old. It was an immediate success. Started out in 8 newspapers, soon was in more than 2,000. And The Twilight Zone had its premiere on this date in 1959, created by Rod Serling. It ran for 5 seasons, and it gave its audience a glimpse of many actors who went on to become big stars: Robert Redford, William Shatner, Robert Duvall, Dennis Hopper, Carol Burnett. It also featured old stars like Buster Keaton and Mickey Rooney. Here's a poem for today by Wallace Stevens, What is Divinity? What is divinity? if it can come only in silent shadows and in dreams? Shall she not find in comforts of the sun, in pungent fruit and bright green wings, or else in any balm or beauty of the earth, things to be cherished like the thought of heaven? Divinity must live within herself, passions of rain or moods in falling snow, grievings in loneliness, or unsubdued elations when the forest blooms, gusty emotions on wet roads on autumn nights, all pleasures and all pains, remembering the bough of summer and the winter branch. These are the measures destined for her soul. Wallace Stevens's poem, What is Divinity?, from the collected poems of Wallace Stevens, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, a service for managing businesses' online image by working to improve how they look in search engines and review sites. Reputation.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, produced by Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 27 minutes after 3 o'clock. If you're a rather regular listener to Juneau Afternoon, you'll know that every Tuesday through the month of September and October, we're doing a special exploration of Juneau's sustainability. We've looked at farmers markets. We've talked with the National Weather Service about the possibilities of flooding and other disasters that could occur in Juneau as a weather side. And today we're going to talk about, well, I think I was going to title this segment something like Trash Talk, but I don't know if I can get away with that. Jim Pinar from the city is here, and we're going to spend a little time talking about the waste stream in Juneau and what we can do about it. So welcome, Jim.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You bet. Jim, I guess the way I wanted to approach this is I was sitting around the house and I was thinking about all of the things that I've got to get rid of this next couple of weeks or so. And this is just a pretty much normal week. I expect that I will have a bag of garbage each day that I pretty much pin down as much as I can. We're going to do one of these later shows. I'm asking five of my friends who are into gardening to talk to us about different kinds of composting. So that takes care of most of the organic waste, which people do not have to put in their garbage cans. But I constantly wonder what to do with metal that I accumulate. I do a little shop work and stuff like that, and I wind up with metal parts that I don't need anymore and like that. What should one in Juneau do with those?
There's two private companies that recycle metals here. Actually three, but Skookum is in the business of recycling metals. They are taking junk vehicles currently right now, advertising taking junk vehicles for free. Also, if you remove the fluids and I believe the tires, they'll actually pay you a little bit for the vehicle. Other household, let's say, metals you could generate, let's say white goods, let's say washers, dryers, hot water tanks, that can be taken to Skookum also, but the landfill also accepts that, and they put it in trailers to get shipped south for recycling.
And do those things actually sell to somebody? Did we get money for sending those out of the
state? Unfortunately, because of our circumstance, no. We have our transportation costs in and out, so that pretty much eats up any possible profit. And on the white goods and that scrap metal like that, car excluding cars, white goods in that basically is your lower end metal, so you're not making as much. As a matter of fact, I think it costs more to ship it out than you get per ton for it.
Now, I think Skookum will actually purchase aluminum and copper.
Sure.
I think he pays for those two.
Yeah. And aluminum's your high. That's why I like the source separated recycling programs. Source separated recycling programs. Because we get the higher value. I think last I checked, and it's been a month or so, aluminum was about $1,600 a ton.
Hmm. And copper, I know, is valuable enough that people in some parts of the world have actually lost wiring out of houses under construction due to thievery of the wires after they've been strung in the walls.
Yeah, copper, brass, and all that has the higher value. And like I say, if we were down south, you'd get some pretty good money for it. But we have shipping costs. But that is a high value metals.
Now, every month during most of the year, there is a hazardous waste event. Usually on a Sunday, and it's over by Costco at that yard over there. They rearrange the roads, and you have to drive differently to get into Costco.
Right.
But if you get in that line, they'll take a lot of stuff. What will they take?
All your household hazardous waste generated stuff. They'll take oils, paints, lacquers, thinners, antifreeze. A variety of stuff. You can get on Juno.org and get into the hazardous waste section, and we have a pretty good list there of what they will take. They also take CRTs and TVs, computer monitors and TVs, because of the lead and mercury in them.
Now, isn't there a limit of one electronic device per household?
One TV and one computer monitor per household, but here, September 12th, we had our own CBJ electronic event. It was on a Wednesday from 5 to 9. I did very little. I did advertise on it. Well, put it this way. We did pretty good. We got a little over 15 ton.
Are you going to do those again?
Yes. I believe that we're going to study how we did it, and I believe we're going to make that a continuing process and have that e-waste collected. I'm just not sure how we're going to go about it yet.
Believe it or not, just at the moment, I have four computers that I need to get rid of. Can I take those to a hazardous waste event?
No. Unfortunately, our current contract with our contractor does not include towers and CUPs because they're not really considered a hazardous waste.
Mm.
But because of the new technology and recycling procedures, they do have a high value. And so my current contract with the contractor for our hazardous waste event, they are currently on a month-to-month, and I'm looking at refurbishing or refabbing that whole operation. I'd actually like to see a six-month, 2 days a week fixed facility operation.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And I'm working on that right now.
That would be a big help to those of us that have bottles of oil and other things around the house who do the work on our own cars and things like that.
There's a couple issues on that. Number one is that, you know, we're kind of victims of our own success. The program's been highly successful. Our events are growing. We're getting more material collected, and the collecting on 7 or 8 events per year makes a line of traffic. It's very inconvenient for the citizens to come and sit in line and try to get to it. I know that we can save monies by having a fixed facility, and it would also lessen the burden on the traffic and lines. We're kind of a victim of our own success, and we need to refurbish that program.
I hope you do. Now, I have two car batteries I've got to get rid of. But these are not car batteries. These are actually batteries that would go into a Cat tractor. And somebody told me I might be able to sell those for core.
Yeah, the car vehicle batteries in Seattle right now are bringing about $6.50 a piece. Now, you're talking larger equipment batteries, and I definitely would check with NAPA, CMI out there, and then also Caterpillar. And they very well may take them. I don't know whether they pay a form or not, but I think they would take them because they have a value. There's also that R&D recycling, and they've been paying for batteries also.
So now, Jim, a few months ago, they converted all of our they finally went to street side recycling, and they allow us now to have these blue bins at our house and like that. My neighbor has one, and he and I have worked out a kind of a sharing arrangement on it because he says he'll never be able to fill it up. I'm wondering what all I can put in there.
Yeah, that program.
What can't I put in there? Maybe that's a better question.
Basically, glass and food waste. That program's run by Arrow Refuse, the collection company that has a certificate for collecting waste here in Juneau area. And that curbside is it's called co-mingled. So basically co-mingled, you can throw everything in the can that they're recycling, and it comes down to the same things that you would take out to the recycling center, separated only in your can, except for glass. You can put cardboard, tin, mixed paper, just no food and no glass.
So I'm sure I'm not going to remember all this, which means when I've got something in my hand and I'm trying to decide if it ought to go into a trash can or if it ought to go somewhere else, is there any way I can do a telephone call or can I get some advice, a web page, something?
Yeah, on Juneau.org, we have a website under the Public Works and the Recycling, and that has a lot of good information in it. You can also, I believe, probably call Arrow Refuse. They're the ones that do the curbside program. They pick up the curbside recycling, and they have a contract with Waste Management to process it into bales and ship it south.
Okay. So all in all, it sounds like it's not quite as hopeless as it first seems when you drive by and look at Mount Trashmore and think that there's no way we can avoid building that landfill up until it obscures the sky. If people follow all of these tips, they could actually remove the waste stream from their house in ways that would allow us to recycle a big bunch of it.
We definitely have some opportunities there. We also have some challenges. It comes with challenges. We've done extremely well in the recycling arena, but there could be more possible composting, or at least looking into that, maybe a private company. There could be more diversion of wood waste that isn't happening that goes in there. Food waste for composting, that's a possibility. We have the bear issues. I know there is some local people here that compost successfully and don't have bear problems, but I think the commercial or the volume of food waste we generate would have to be like a in-vessel compost system to remove the VOCs, the odors and the smell of food from the bears. So we got that to deal with. I got some numbers here really quickly to throw out. So everybody can see that we have progressively been getting better. And 2006, and all these numbers, you know, starting off the smaller ones, the cardboard, we did 373 tons of cardboard in 2006. In 2012, we did 609. White office paper, we did 125 tons in 2006. We did 279 in 2012. The biggest one with the jump would be our plastics have stayed pretty much the same. They went from 28 tons in 2006 to 53. Glass went from 270 to 450. But the mixed waste paper, and I like to bring this one up because I think we can get there with cardboard too. I think there's a lot of cardboard that we aren't getting out of the waste stream that's getting landfilled that has a high dollar value, but the mixed waste paper, we did 93 tons in 2006. In 2012, we did 1,025 tons. And I think we could get there. White office paper and mixed paper has a pretty good value on it, but cardboard, that's on my radar.
Jim Panori, who works with the city, tells us about what to do with the hazardous waste in our back rooms, and has been extremely helpful in helping me to figure out how to talk about things in this program. Jim, we'll probably have you back in a later edition of the Waste Stream when we talk about what to do with waste from building and construction sites.
Oh, I'd be glad to be back, and thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
The guy in the studio recognizes his fingers, I think, in the background. That's you. Oh, you don't? Okay, well, anyway, here. Joining me here is Barney McClure, back in town doing the same workshop that he's done now for, a long number of years in Juneau.
A long time.
Yeah, welcome back, Barney.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you're doing it again, and you're doing a big show Friday night,
We're
right?
doing the cabaret, Swinging in the Rain, they're calling it. I think it used to be Singing in the Rain. And it's bigger and better than ever. And I just did one, 5-6 months ago in Juneau, and I've got more people than ever signed up. I just realized the other day that I've been doing these for 27 years, and it went by so fast I was surprised.
Haven't noticed.
But I've been doing them in Juneau since 1999, and sometimes, like this year, twice a year.
Yeah. Yeah, you were here just 6 months ago, I think.
It was in May.
Right? May, yeah.
For the Juneau Jazz and Classics.
Yeah. So how many you got lined up going through the course?
We have 26 people right now.
Okay, and let's see.
And we can handle up to 30, but 25, 26 is a real comfortable number.
First meetings with them was last night, right?
No, it was Sunday.
Sunday. Okay, So you're in the third night tonight.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right, and things are moving along pretty well. I can't tell you how impressed I am this time for whatever reason. Maybe it's technology. Everybody seems ready and pumped, and they're all geared to go. They know all the protocol, the drill. We've done it so many times, but I was really impressed with how people have their music ready to go. It's a fun group of people.
Are most of your students returning?
I don't call them students or participants because they're all, in my opinion,
the stars of Friday night
great
show.
Great singers, yes. Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
All right.
I have about 50% new people each time. I only have about 10% new people this time. So a lot of returnees.
When somebody comes in on Sunday night, or Sunday at the first one of these things, what kinds of... I don't know exactly how to ask this. How quickly do you know what you're going to need to do with this person? That's
what a great question. I do rely on my 150 years of playing experience, to come to the fore. And so I can pretty well figure out what a person's needs are. You know, really, it isn't about music that I teach. It's about opening doors and giving people permission to do stuff they were afraid to do. And it really has little to do with music, because you open your mouth and all of us can sing in one way or another, and we can keep basic time, and we love music, and we've learned some tunes that we like. It really doesn't boil down to that. It's getting us saying, okay, no, you're doing a good job then, and look at this, try it this way, and just getting people to be more comfortable in their own bodies.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you give me more of a for instance than that? Like, for instance, do it this way. What would you be responding to?
Well, I might be responding to somebody who has a four-note range. They have a good, strong musical sense, but they don't have a big range. And oftentimes I'm responding to people who really have a good voice, but they've never been told that. They've never been on a stage. And more often than not, if I'm dealing with anything... it's that fear of staring at a microphone and a whole bunch of people in an audience staring back at you. And so I find that a lot of people really have not had a lot of microphone experience. And there's a certain amount of protocol, which you know very well. And we work through that. That'll be part of our sessions. And how to walk on the stage, how to walk off, how to make a tune begin and end. A lot of stuff that really doesn't have anything to do with their singing.
So now let's talk about a returnee. This is kind of like you've unleashed this monster in an earlier session, and now he or she comes back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you start back at the base, or do you say, okay, so now you know that stuff, here's some more, or how's that relationship work?
In that we always have new people, I always have to cover certain basics, like how to handle a microphone, for example. And I always tell the experienced ones, just listen, you need some refreshers there anyway. But the more people I have like this session, for example, it does grease it a lot faster. We can move along a lot faster without a lot of the protocol and basics. each person presents a different challenge. And, for example, our dean, Womack, has done every cabaret that I've ever done in Juneau. And that means 11 or 12. We've lost count. And she's done every one. So certainly she knows all the rules and protocol. But each time I see her, she presents me with a new tune. So I have a new challenge. Mm-hmm. I'm using her as an example. But it's true with literally everybody. The experienced ones still are seeking to do something new. And I'm always pushing them to do an original interpretation of the music they're doing. They don't want to do a cover, do it like Whitney Houston or do it like Frank Sinatra. I want them to do it like them. And that's my job as the pianist and accompanist, is also to make it so it's different.
Too late to get in now?
We'd welcome you with open arms. It's not.
It's not? Okay. So the sessions are when?
We have two, and they're the same, so you choose one or the other. 5:30 to 7, 7:30, and then 8 o'clock to 10 is the second session. They're both the same, so you come to one or the other. And then everybody's entitled to a half-hour time with me, and that truly is when their piece takes shape, is when they have that half-hour with me.
The concert is 8 o'clock.
This Friday evening, 8 o'clock. The doors won't open until 7:30, so there's a half hour to get in and get your seat. It's always packed, and there's your friends, your neighbors, your workmates, your relatives are there. It's $20 to get in. There's a little light snacks, a no-host bar.
And we should stress, this is your friends and neighbors, but you won't recognize them after Barney's done with
them,
because
right.
He will
you
have turned them into stars of stage, screen, radio, and TV in 1 week.
That's right.
Barney, thank you so much for bringing
for
this to us every year without fail.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Music's by Barney McClure. He'll be teaching the class that he teaches through the years, I guess 12 times so far in the past, where he's done these getting people prepared for cabaret. And then the concert is Friday night at 8 p.m. at the Jack, Swinging in the Rain. You better get tickets now if you want to go, because it is packed every year. My next guest is packed with information in a different way. Ryan Alsup is here from JDHS and is going to tell us about the ways in which our high school students are being assessed. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm real good, particularly with Barney McClure's music behind me. It's even easier.
Oh, yeah, that makes it nice. Plus, you know, looking outside your window here and seeing sun is always a positive thing.
Well, yeah. And it turns out that that's going to happen. We've got a weekend coming up. According to this, it's going to be raining tonight and maybe tomorrow, and then it's supposed to clear off again, and we're going to have sun on weekend.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
I think we all deserve that. So anyway, I'm sure the people don't want to hear me talk about the weather. So I just wanted to come in today and talk about assessments. And in particular, I'll cover all of the assessments quickly, but in particular, there's an assessment called PISA, which is a Program for International Student Assessment. It's something that JDHS is the only high school in Alaska that has been selected to give this assessment. But anyway, as people probably know, in the high school or any school settings, there's a number of assessments that we give our students. Currently, we are wrapping up the MAP, which is the Measure of Academic Progress. We give that assessment three times a year, spring, winter, and fall. And our fall, winter, spring. I apologize, saying that backwards. But anyway, our fall window is closing as we speak. And the intent of that assessment at the high school level, we give it to our 9th and 10th graders. And it gives our teachers quite a bit of tools, if you will, as far as helping them identify the students' weaknesses, and in the various assessments help show us if we're making any ground there. So that is the MAP assessment. But the next assessment, the one I want to spend the bulk of the time on, is something that is going to be taking place on Tuesday, which is that international assessment that I just referred to. And basically, here's what happened. Last year, about August, I received a letter from the U.S. Department of Education saying we've been selected to give this assessment. And you kind of look at it and you think, well, what is PISA? And I'm not sure if the people out in our audience are familiar with this, but any time you hear any type of data that compares the American students to the rest of the world, whether it be our ability to perform in math, science, et cetera, they're the only source of data that they currently use is the PISA assessment. So long story short, I went to a training conference on this assessment this summer to learn more about it. The conference itself was 2 days. I don't want to spend 2 days talking about it, but I wanted to make sure that people knew that this was coming up on Tuesday. Now, because it's an international assessment, we don't assess by grade level. We assess an age group. And so what the folks did is they selected at random 50 students from our school that are age 15. And this is going to go on around the world. There's currently 67 countries that participate in this assessment. And it grows every year. In the early 80s when they started using this, I think there was 12 countries. Now we're up to 67. And once again, it's a fantastic opportunity for us. So, originally, and you'll hear as I go over our assessment calendar here, we do have a lot of assessments. And so I debated whether or not this is a voluntary thing for us. I debated whether or not we wanted to be part of it. But then when I talked with the folks that put this on and found we're the only high school in Alaska that has been selected to do this, I felt like it was a good opportunity for us. To me, the huge advantage as a principal is we're going to see how our kids score on the international stage. And I'm extremely excited about that. The downfall is because it's an international assessment, we won't receive those, even the preliminary results until next school year. So it takes quite a bit of time to put all of this together, as you can imagine.
But 15-year-olds would normally be like sophomores, right?
Yeah, most of them are sophomores. There's a couple freshmen and a couple juniors in that mix. But, they're sophomores. And as a matter of fact, right now, those students don't know they've been selected. So a letter is going out today to the families, as well as an email, a mass email to the families of the students that have been selected. And one of the things that I want to make sure that I make clear in case those families who receive this letter don't see this, we will have an informational meeting on this Friday at JDHS at 5 o'clock, which is why we're sending the email. I'm not sure the mail will be received in time. But we just received our list of students who were selected, and I want to make sure we get this out. And because it's a study, the students who have been selected actually get a stipend for participating. So the government gives them a stipend for that. There's two portions of this test. The morning portion that'll have all 50 students is a paper and pencil test, and I believe the stipend for that's $25. And there's an afternoon session which the assessment people who give the test will select 20 students out of that 50 to take a computer portion of the test, and I believe the stipend for that's another $15. So they've provided financial incentives to get the kids to participate because, once again, this is all voluntary. But it's once again, I believe it's a wonderful opportunity for us to see where we rate. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, it sounds like a real exciting opportunity. Now, the other one that you have on here on the list is one of my favorite crossword puzzle answers, which is the PSAT. They always say a task or something like a test for juniors or something.
Oh,
like
that. The high school qualifying exam or
the PSAT?
Oh, yeah, the PSAT. Oh, yeah, okay. So we actually have a number of them. Yeah, so the PSAT is also coming up. And that's on Wednesday the 17th. We actually will give that assessment to all of our sophomores. And it's another opportunity for us, to see how we score on the national stage. Over the last couple of years, we actually beat the national average on the PSAT scores. And to put that into perspective, there's not a lot of schools or a lot of districts that have all of their sophomores taking it. It's generally, for 10th graders, it's generally a something if, you know, if you're out, if you're expecting to get a, you know, a good scholarship or go off to a really strong university, is where sophomores usually take this. But for us, we have all of our kids take it. So the fact that that we beat the national average when we're having all of our kids take it is a phenomenal thing, I think, as well. And really, what we do with that is something I'm really excited about, is that when we receive those results, the PSAT is the pre-SAT put on by College Board. And so what College Board does when they give us the data, we get that back in late December. It tells us, basically it breaks it down, the kids' scores and their, and then what they also put on a portion on there that says AP ready for the advanced placement classes. And there's a number of kids who aren't in honors classes who maybe didn't realize that they had this ability. Not all of a sudden this test shows us, hey, wait a minute, you know, you can strive for some greatness here. And so we put on a parent night in January, a celebration in January every year or last couple of years, that is put on by your parent group, but it's to celebrate grade point averages as well as those students who received high marks on the PSAT. So stay tuned for that. You'll definitely hear more about that as time comes as far as that celebration evening. But it's been a wonderful opportunity to see students take part in that.
So we have about a minute left. You mentioned the high school qualifying exam.
Okay, so currently, today, tomorrow, and Thursday, those students who have not completed a portion of the high school qualifying exam or have not passed a portion, they are taking the high school qualifying exams these next 3 days at all three of our high schools. This is also open to people who had since aged out of school but just need that qualifying exam to graduate. So if you're one of those people out there, please contact your counseling office of your high school and come on in, take a test.
Any other tests we need to talk about in the last few seconds?
Well, just a couple seconds. We have the SAT, which is being given at the high school on the 6th, and the ASVAB, which is the career interest inventory put on by the military, is being given on the 23rd. And real quickly, the military doesn't contact you unless you want them to.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Ryan Alsop, principal at JDHS, picking us up on what our assessment looks like in the high school.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Barney McClure's music in the background. The Juno Ski Club is having its general membership and board meeting on Wednesday, October 3rd. It's at 6:30 p.m. It's at Thunder Mountain High School. All members are encouraged to attend. The public is welcome also. Topics are to be discussed include program fees, race schedules, and the ski sale. Join Andy Klein tomorrow. He'll have Michael Howard on here to talk about a concert Friday at the Rookery. Kimberly Naylor from the City Museum will be here to highlight First Friday's exhibit celebrating the centennial of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. Joel Mundy will talk about his First Friday exhibit at the UAS Bookstore. And Jenny Del Rosario with Jackie Manning will talk about the State Museum's new exhibit on the Philippines and Alaska. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We're also on a set of translators throughout the area in the valley. In Hawk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, you get a better signal at 101.7 on K269 AO. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM. It's on 88.1 megahertz out there. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9. Of course, you can always receive us on 871 on DGCI Cable Juno and our sister stations on the two adjacent channels.